This is Audible.
Clipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of The Other Side of the Bridge by Mary Lawson, narrated by Paul Hecht and directed by Jeff Barron. This book is copyrighted 2006 by Mary Lawson. This recording is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books. Two brothers, Arthur and Jake Dunn, are the sons of a local farmer in the mid-1930s, when life is tough and World War II is looming. When a beautiful young woman arrives in the community, their already frayed relationship comes very close to the breaking point. And now, The Other Side of the Bridge.
Prologue. There was a summer back when they were kids, when Arthur Dunn was 13 or 14, and his brother Jake was 8 or 9, when for weeks on end Jake pestered Arthur to play the game he called knives. Jake had a great collection of knives at the time, everything from fancy little Swiss Army jackknives with dozens of attachments to a big, sleek hunting knife with a runnel down one side for blood. It was the hunting knife that was to be used in the game because, according to Jake, it was the best for throwing. "Just once, okay?" Jake would say, dancing about barefoot in the dust of the farmyard, tossing the knife from hand to hand like a juggler, leaping back quickly if it decided to fall blade first. "Come on, just once. It'll only take a minute." "I'm busy," Arthur would say, and carry on with whatever task his father had set him to. It was the summer holidays, and the list of tasks was unending, but it was better than going to school. "Come on," Jake would say. "Come on, you'll love it. It's a really good game. Come on." "I gotta fix this hinge." Jake had explained the rules of the knife game to him, and it was crazy. You stood at attention, facing each other about 6 feet apart, and took turns throwing the knife into the ground as close as possible to your opponent's naked foot. You had to be barefoot, Jake explained, or there would be no point to the game. Wherever the knife landed, your opponent had to move his foot alongside it. The idea was to make him do the splits bit by bit as slowly as possible. The more throws, the better. The smaller the distance between the still vibrating steel and the outer edge of your brother's foot, the better. Nuts. But in the end, as they had both known he would, Jake wore Arthur down. That was Jake's specialty, wearing people down. It was a warm evening in July, the end of a long, hot day out in the fields, and Arthur was sitting on the back step doing nothing, which was always a mistake. Jake appeared around the corner of the house and saw him, and his eyes started to shine. Jake had dark blue eyes and a pale triangular face and hair the color of wheat. In build, he was slight and reedy, frail was the word their mother used, and already good-looking, though not as good-looking as he would be later. Arthur, 5 years older, was big and slow and heavy, with sloping shoulders and a neck like an ox. Jake had the knife on him, of course, he always did. He carried it around in its own special sheath, with its own special belt loop, so as to be ready for anything. He started badgering Arthur right away, and eventually Arthur gave in, just to get it over with. "Once, okay?" Arthur said. "Once. I play it once now, and you never ask me again, promise?" "Okay, okay, I promise. Let's go." And so it was that on that warm July evening, when he was 13 or 14 years old, at any rate plenty old enough to know better, Arthur found himself standing behind the line his little brother had drawn in the dust, waiting to have a knife thrown at his bare and vulnerable feet. The dust felt hot, warmer than the air, and soft as talcum powder. It puffed up between his toes every time he took a step and turned them a pale and ghostly gray. Arthur's feet were broad and meaty with red raw patches from his heavy farm boots. Jake's feet were long and thin, delicate and blue-veined. Jake didn't wear farm boots much. He was considered by their mother to be too young for farm labor, though Arthur hadn't been too young at the same age. Jake had first throw by virtue of it being his game and his knife. "Stand at attention," he said. His eyes were fixed on Arthur's left foot, and he spoke in a hushed voice. He had a great feeling for the drama of the moment, had Jake. "Keep your feet together. Don't move them, no matter what." He took the knife by the blade and began swinging it loosely between finger and thumb. His forefinger rested easily in the blood runnel. He seemed scarcely to be holding the knife at all. Arthur watched the blade. In spite of himself, he felt his left foot curl inward. "Keep it still," Jake said. "I'm warning you." Arthur forced his foot to lie flat. The thought came into his mind, not drifting gently in, but appearing suddenly, fully formed like a cold, hard, round little pebble, that Jake hated him. The thought had never occurred to him before, but suddenly there it was, though he couldn't imagine a reason. Surely he was the one who should have done the hating. The knife swung for a minute more, and then, in one swift, graceful movement, Jake lifted his arm and threw, and the blade circled, drawing swift, shining arcs in the air, and then buried itself deeply in the ground, a couple of inches from the outside edge of Arthur's foot. A beautiful throw. Jake's eyes left the ground, and he grinned at Arthur. "That's one," he said. "Your turn. Move your foot out to the knife." Arthur moved his foot outward to the edge of the knife and drew the blade from the ground. The skin on the top of his left foot was stinging, though nothing had touched it. He straightened up. Jake stood facing him, still grinning, arms at his sides, feet together, eyes bright, excited, but without fear. Without fear because, and Arthur saw this suddenly too, Jake knew that Arthur would never risk throwing really close. Arthur imagined his mother's face if he were to prove Jake wrong and slice off his toe. He imagined what his father would do to him if he were even to catch him playing this stupid game. He couldn't think how he'd allowed Jake to persuade him. He must have been mad. "Come on," Jake said. "Come on, come on, come on. Close as you can." Arthur held the knife by the blade as Jake had done, but it was hard to relax his fingers enough to let it swing. He'd thrown a knife before, and he wasn't too bad a shot. In fact, a few years back, he and his friend Carl Luntz from the next farm had painted a target on the wall of the Luntz's hay barn and held competitions, which Arthur usually won. But the outcome had never mattered. Now, the chance that he would hit that narrow, blue-veined foot seemed overwhelmingly high. And then, all at once, he saw the answer. So obvious that only someone as dim-witted as he must surely be wouldn't have seen it earlier. Throw wide. Not so wide that Jake would guess he was doing it deliberately, but wide enough to bring the game to a safe and rapid close. Make Jake do the splits in three or four steps. Jake would jeer, but he was going to jeer anyway, and the game would be over, and Jake would have to leave him alone. Arthur felt his muscles start to relax. The knife swung more easily. He took a deep breath and threw. The knife circled clumsily, once in the air, and then landed on its side 18 inches or so from Jake's foot. Jake said, "That's pathetic. Take it again. It's got to stick in the ground or it doesn't count." Arthur picked up the knife, swung again, and threw more confident now. And this time the knife embedded itself in the ground 10 inches from Jake's little toe. Jake made a sound of disgust. He moved his foot out to the blade and picked it up. He looked disappointed and pitying, which was fine by Arthur. "Okay," Jake said, "my turn." He took the knife by the blade and swung it back and forth, looking briefly at Arthur. And when their eyes met, there was a slight pause, just a fraction of a second, during which the knife hesitated in its lazy swing and then picked up its rhythm again. Thinking back on it afterward, Arthur was never able to decide whether there was any significance in that pause, whether in that instant of eye contact Jake had seen into his mind and guessed what he had intended to do. At the time, he didn't think anything because there was no time to think. Jake lifted the knife with the same swift movement as before and threw it, but harder than before, and faster, so that it was only a shining blur as it spun through the air. Arthur found himself staring down at the knife, embedded in his foot. There was a surreal split second before the blood started to well up, and then up it came, dark and thick as syrup. Arthur looked at Jake and saw that he was staring at the knife. His expression was one of surprise, and this was something that Arthur wondered about later, too. Was Jake surprised because he had never considered the possibility that he might be a less-than-perfect shot? Did he have that much confidence in himself, that little self-doubt? Or was he merely surprised at how easy it was to give in to an impulse and carry through the thought that lay in your mind? Simply to do whatever you wanted to do, and damn the consequences. Chapter 1. Firefighters battle bushfire. Lost bear hunter located by plane. In bush, 40 hours. Temiskaming speaker, May 1957. On a small farm, about 2 miles outside Struan, there lived a beautiful woman. She was tall and willowy, with a lot of fair hair that she drew back into a thick plait and tied with whatever came to hand, a bit of frayed ribbon, an elastic band, an old piece of string. On Sundays she rolled it into a shining ball at the nape of her neck, and fastened it somehow so that it wouldn't fall down during church. Her name was Laura Dunn. Laura, her own name, soft and beautiful like she was. Dunn, her husband's name, solid and lumpen like her husband. Arthur Dunn was a farmer, a big, heavy-set man with a neck at least twice the width of his wife's, and to Ian, sitting with his parents 3 pews behind, he looked about as exciting as dishwater. Ian had first noticed Laura Dunn when he was 14. She must have been around all his life, but that was the year he became aware of her. She would have been about 30 at the time. She and Arthur had 3 children, or possibly 4. Ian wasn't sure. He'd never paid any attention to the children. For a year, he made do with watching her in church on Sundays. The Dunns came into town for church every Sunday without fail. Then, when he was 15, Ian's father said that he should get a job, working Saturdays and holidays, and start saving up for his further education. The theory being that you appreciated things more if you'd helped to pay for them yourself. Ian couldn't recall anyone asking him if he wanted more education. It was another of the many assumptions people made about his life. But, in this particular case, he didn't argue. He got on his bike and cycled out to the Dunn's farm. The farm was an oddity in the Struan area because Arthur Dunn still worked his land with horses. It wasn't because he couldn't afford a tractor, the farm was prosperous enough, and it wasn't through any religious convictions like the Mennonites farther south. When asked about it, Arthur would study the ground thoughtfully as if the question had never occurred to him before, and then say that he guessed he liked horses. No one bought that explanation, though. They all believed that Arthur had been put off tractors years earlier when his father got one and drove it down to the lower 40, where he rolled it into a ditch and killed himself, all within 2 hours of its arrival on the farm. Even the youngest and least intelligent of the plow horses would have known better than to fall into a ditch. The day after the funeral, Arthur got rid of the tractor and harnessed up the team again, and he'd been plodding along behind them ever since. He was out in the fields when Ian cycled up to the farm. Ian saw him off in the distance being towed along by 2 great heavy-footed animals, like a picture postcard of a time gone by. Ian leaned his bike up against the pump, which he guessed would only be used to fill the water trough. All but the most remote farms in the area had running water, and electricity, too. They'd been connected up to the grid 2 years ago, when the power lines were run in for the sawmill. Ian picked his way between the chickens to the back door. There was a front door on the other side of the house, but he figured no one ever used it. It would lead into the sitting room, where probably no one ever sat, whereas the back door led into the kitchen, which was where life would be lived. He could hear Laura Dunn talking as he climbed the 3 steps to the door. The inner door was open, letting the sound of voices out, but the screen door was closed, making it difficult to see in. She was scolding one of the kids by the sound of it, though Ian couldn't make out the words because a baby was crying. Her voice wasn't sharp and sarcastic, as Ian's mother's voice tended to be when she was annoyed about something. It was exasperated, but still gentle and light, or so it seemed to Ian. There was a lull in the baby's crying, and Ian, standing on the top step with his hand lifted, ready to knock on the door, heard Laura Dunn say, "Well, for goodness sake, Carter, couldn't you share it? Couldn't you let her have a turn?" And a boy's voice said, "She never shares hers." And a little girl's voice wailed, "I do so." And the baby started to howl again. There was the sound of a chair being scuffed along the floor, and then the screen door was flung open, nearly knocking Ian off the step, and a boy charged out. He gave Ian a startled, angry glance before jumping off the steps and disappearing around the side of the house. He looked about 11 or 12 and had the sort of face, Ian thought, that made you want to hit him. The sullen, sulky face of a kid who thinks the world is against him. The screen door slammed closed again, and Laura Dunn appeared behind it. She gave a start when she saw Ian standing there and said, Oh, hello, it's Ian, isn't it, Dr. Christofferson's son?
Yes, Ian said, yes, I've come to talk to Mr. Dunn about a job. I wondered if he'd be taking on anyone this summer. I mean, full-time this summer, but maybe Saturdays right away, and then full-time once the holidays start.
He felt himself flushing. He was gabbling because she was so near, just inches away behind the screen door, and she was looking at him directly, and only at him with those wonderful soft eyes. Eyes that he'd noticed always seemed shadowed, as if they contained deep, unfathomable mysteries. Or, the possibility occurred to him now, what with the crying of the baby and the behavior of the kids, as if she were tired all the time.
"Oh," she said, "oh, well, yes, I'm sure he'd be glad of some help. Just a minute, Ian, I'll come out, just a minute."
She disappeared. Ian heard her say something to somebody, and then she reappeared with a baby in her arms. A little girl was behind her, but she shrank back when she saw Ian standing there. He moved down off the steps, and Laura came out bouncing the baby gently up and down on her hip. The baby was fat and sexless like all babies, and had round, unconvincing tears rolling down its cheeks. It and Ian looked at each other, and the baby gave a sort of snort, as if it didn't think much of what it saw, and put its thumb in its mouth. "There now," Laura said, brushing the top of its head with her lips. "That's better. This is Ian. Say hello to Ian."
"Hi," Ian said.
He smiled warily at the baby. It stared back, and then curled up and buried its face in the folds of Laura's dress, its free hand clutching possessively at her breast. Ian quickly looked down at his feet.
"The thing is, you'll really need to speak to Arthur," Laura was saying. "He's plowing at the moment."
She nodded in the direction of the picture postcard view of her husband.
"If you'd like to go out and have a word with him, just along that track there."
She looked doubtfully at Ian's bike.
"Only I think you'd be better to walk. The horses cut up the path a bit, but I'm sure he'll be pleased. It's so hard to get help. Men nowadays don't know how to deal with horses, you see."
She smiled at him.
"But maybe you like them.
Is that why you've come?
Well, sort of, Ian said. He hadn't given the work of the farm, the actual job he was applying for, a thought. Arthur Dunn could have hitched his plow to a moose for all he cared.
At the moment, all his attention was taken up with trying not to look at the baby, which had now, unbelievably, wormed its hand inside its mother's dress and was tugging at what it found in there, all the while making fretful smacking noises with its lips.
Laura gently disengaged the small hand.
"Shush," she said to the baby.
She smiled at Ian again, seeming not to notice his embarrassment.
"Come back, and let me know what he says, all right?"
Ian nodded and turned, his mind filled to the brim with the nearness of her, her overwhelming presence, and made his way down the muddy track to where Arthur Dunn was plodding up and down the furrows behind his horses. Arthur Dunn, so solid, so dull, so obviously unworthy of such a wife. Arthur Dunn, who when he saw Ian approaching, halted his team and came across the field to meet him, and said yeah, sure he could use a hand, and would Ian like to start this coming Saturday. Ian's grandfather had been Struan's first resident doctor, and when he'd answered the doctor wanted advertisement they'd put in a Toronto medical journal, the grateful townspeople built him a house just a block west of Main Street, a couple of hundred yards from the lake. It was a handsome wooden structure, white-painted and green-trimmed, with lawns on all four sides and a white picket fence surrounding the lawns. In the early days, there was a neat white stable for the horse and buggy 20 yards from the house. Later, the first Dr. Christofferson acquired a Buick Roadster, which became as much a part of him as his old black leather medical bag, and a garage was added beside the stable. He kept the horse for use in winter, when the back roads around Struan were impassable by anything except a sled.
His son, the present Dr. Christofferson, who also drove a Buick, though his was the sedan, was sometimes heard lamenting the absence of the sled even now, given the state of the town's one and only snowplow. As much as anything else, the building of the house had been a statement of faith on the part of the people of Struan. Until then, they'd had to go to New Liskeard if they required a doctor, and if you needed medical help badly enough to make the journey to New Liskeard, the odds were that you were in no state to make the journey.
Getting their own doctor was a sign that the town had arrived. In the brief interval between applying the final coat of paint and the arrival of Dr. Christofferson, the people of Struan found excuses to walk past the house and admire it. You looked at that house, and you thought, this is no fly-by-night northern settlement sprung up around a sawmill. Any town that can afford to build its doctor a house like this is here to stay. Ian was aware of most of this personal and civic history, and as far as he was concerned, his grandfather must have been raving mad. Imagine voluntarily leaving a city like Toronto to come to a hick town like Struan, and though you could excuse his grandfather's mistake on the grounds of ignorance, he couldn't have had any real idea what he was coming to, there was no such excuse for Ian's father. He had been born and brought up in Struan, and had then escaped. But after living in Toronto for almost a decade while he took his medical degree and worked in the sick children's hospital, he had returned to Struan to take over his father's practice. Ian couldn't understand it. Why would anyone do such a thing? What was Struan, apart from a sawmill? A sorry bunch of stores lined up along a dusty main street with nothing in them anyone would want to buy. A couple of churches, the Hudson's Bay Company, a post office, a bank, Harper's Restaurant, Ben's Bar, a hotel, because incredibly some people chose to come to Struan for their holidays, and a little clutch of holiday cottages down by the lake. The lake was the town's only asset, in Ian's opinion. It was large, 50 miles long north to south, and almost 20 miles across, and deep and very clear, surrounded on all sides by low granite hills studded with spruce and wind-blasted pines.
Its shore was so ragged with bays and inlets and islands that you could spend your life exploring and never find half of them. When Ian dreamed of leaving the town, which he did all the time nowadays, the thought of leaving the lake was the only thing that bothered him. The lake and Laura Dunn. He parked his bike up against the veranda of the house, climbed the wide wooden steps to the porch, and went in. The door to his father's office was closed, and he could hear voices behind it, but the waiting room was empty, so Ian sat down on one of the dozen or so battered old chairs lining the walls and flicked through a 2-year-old copy of Reader's Digest while he thought about Laura Dunn. The way strands of her hair escaped from their elastic band and drifted around her face. Those shadowed eyes, her breasts. He noticed, he couldn't help noticing, that on the front of her dress there had been 2 wet circles where her breasts had leaked milk. The door to the office opened, and Ted Pickett, owner of Pickett's Hardware, came out with his arm in a sling. He nodded at Ian and grimaced, and Ian grimaced back. Patience entered the house by a side door, but both the office and the waiting room were right off the hall, so all his life he'd been used to seeing people going in and out in varying degrees of anguish, and he'd got his responses down pat. "He doesn't think it's broken," Mr. Pickett said. "That's lucky," Ian said. "He thinks it's just sprained. Hurts like hell, though." Ian nodded sympathetically. "Did you fall off the ladder?" There was a ladder on wheels in the hardware store that Mr. Pickett scooted around on, reaching for nails or nuts or brackets or hinges, an accident waiting to happen. "Yeah," Mr. Pickett said, looking surprised. "How did you know?"
"I just kind of wondered," Ian said politely.
When Mr. Pickett left, he knocked on his father's door and went in. "I got a job," he said. His father had his back to him. He was rolling bandages and placing them neatly back in their drawer. His desk was littered with papers, patients' notes, medical journals, bills. But the tools of his trade were always properly put away.
"That was quick," he said.
"Arthur Dunn's farm," Ian said. "He said I could start Saturday." His father turned around and took off his glasses and blinked at him.
"Arthur Dunn's farm."
"Yes, you know, doing farm work."
"Farm work."
His father nodded vaguely, as if trying to imagine it.
"I thought I'd like something outdoors," Ian said.
Dr. Christofferson put his glasses back on and looked out the window. It had just started to rain.
"Yes," he said doubtfully.
"Well, if that's what you want, Arthur's a nice fellow." He looked dubiously at Ian. "It'll be hard work, you know."
"I know," Ian said.
"Did you see the horses?"
"Yes."
"Magnificent animals."
"Yes," Ian said,
though he had barely noticed them. He and his father smiled at each other, glad to be in agreement. They were usually in agreement, unlike Ian and his mother. Next, he went and told his mother, who was watching I Love Lucy in the living room. Television had finally reached Struan a couple of months earlier, proof, if more were needed, of how backward things were up here. Ian's mother had disapproved of it at first, but now she watched it more than he did. In fact, just lately she seemed to watch it all the time. She was supposed to be in with his father, she was his nurse, but apart from the odd emergency, Ian hadn't seen her in the office for weeks.
"Mom," he said, standing in the doorway. She was in one of her absent moods. He could tell, even though he couldn't see her face. She had 2 moods nowadays, absent or annoyed, and whichever one she was in, he invariably found he preferred the other.
"Mom," he said again. She turned her head a few degrees, not taking her eyes off the screen.
"I've got a job," Ian said.
She turned a little more and met his eyes, and he saw the glazed look fade as she focused on him.
"What was that?"
she said.
"I said I've got a job."
"Oh,"
she said. She smiled at him.
"That's good."
She turned back to the television. Ian waited a minute, but there was no further response, so he went into the kitchen to get a reaction from Mrs. Tuttle instead. She was breading chicken pieces for supper, dipping each piece in a bowl of beaten egg, and then slapping it back and forth in a dish of breadcrumbs.
"I've got a job, Mrs. Tuttle," Ian said.
"Have you now?"
she said, placing a breaded breast down on the baking tray and taking a pale, slippery-looking chicken leg from the hacked-up carcass on the chopping board.
"That's exciting. What is it?"
"Helping Mr. Dunn on his farm."
She paused, then turned her head to look at him. Her glasses were splattered with the day's cooking, a dusting of flour from the tea biscuits, a little smear of butter, a scattering of crumbs, even what looked to be a shred of carrot peel.
"Goodness," she said, ducking her head in order to look over the top of them. "Whatever did you want a job like that for?"
Which was what he'd expected her to say, and therefore satisfying in its way. So he smiled at her and left. His mother was still in front of the television when he passed the living room door on his way upstairs. I Love Lucy had finished, and she was watching a program in French. It struck Ian as strange because she didn't speak French. He wondered if anyone else's mother watched television during the day. It was hard to know. The mothers of most of his friends were farmers' wives and didn't have time to sit down, much less watch TV. But his mother had never been like other people's mothers. She didn't come from the North. She was an outsider, from Vancouver originally. She wore smart shoes with heels, even around the house, and skirts with sweaters that matched, and had her hair set in loose waves instead of tight little corkscrews like the mothers of his friends. In the evenings, she and Ian and his father ate formally in the dining room instead of at the kitchen table. They used napkins, proper white linen ones, washed and starched and ironed by Mrs. Tuttle every Monday. Ian suspected that no one else in the whole of Struan would have the first idea what to do with a napkin. One good thing about his mother's moods of late was that suppers were fairly brief and painless affairs. In the past, they'd been hard work, because she would insist on having what she called a civilized conversation while they ate. That was what evening meals were for, according to her. They were for families to get together and exchange views and experiences in a pleasant environment. Maybe that would have been okay if he'd had half a dozen brothers or sisters to share the burden of thinking up something to say night after night. But there was only him. He didn't see why they couldn't read at the table. He would have preferred it, and he knew his father would as well. You could tell by the wistful, unfocused look in his eyes. He was longing to immerse himself in an article on the renewed threat of polio in rural areas, or the latest wonder drug, or a new type of surgical dressing that didn't stick to wounds. In Ian's case, it would be fishing magazines, a 55-pound muskie caught down in French River, the pros and cons of trolling versus casting, the last word in fishing tackle. He pictured himself and his father, shoulders hunched, chins 6 inches from their plates, absently forking in their dinners, happily absorbed in the printed word. His mother could look at one of her Eaton's catalogues. Why not? It would be much more relaxed, and at least as companionable as the performance they had to go through every night in the name of family togetherness. But in the last little while, she seemed to have lost interest in conversation, civilized or not. Sometimes she still made a half-hearted attempt to get things rolling by saying something like, "So, what has everybody been doing today?" But this evening, she didn't even do that. The three of them ate more or less in silence, he and his father both gazing into the middle distance as they chewed, thinking about the things they would have liked to be reading. And then they all excused themselves from the table and went their separate ways. Ian got on his bike and set off for the reserve. It had rained hard for 10 minutes or so while they were eating, but now it had cleared and the evening air was cool and fresh. The clouds were drifting away out over the lake,
and the pale sky shone in the puddles at the sides of the road. Main Street, the only road out of town, was deserted. The stores closed promptly at 5:30, and the entire population of Struan went home for supper. That was one of the things about the town that exasperated Ian, the way it died in the evenings. The only places that stayed open were Harper's, which served meals until 6:30, 7 o'clock on Fridays, and Ben's. Ben's bar was the nearest thing Struan had to a den of iniquity. Every Saturday night it filled up with men from the logging camp upriver who came into town to spend their week's wages on liquor. They'd get completely hammered, cause Sergeant Moynihan and Ian's father between them no end of trouble, and then go back to the camp, and the town would settle back into its usual dull, predictable self for another week. For many years, Ian hadn't given the town a thought because it was all he knew. But the previous summer his mother had taken him to Toronto for a week, and his eyes had been opened. What had impressed him most hadn't been the size of the city or the noise or even the buildings. He'd been expecting all of that. What had struck him most forcibly was the fact that when he walked down the street, he hadn't known anyone. Thousands upon thousands of strangers. He'd found it amazing, liberating. Contrast it with Struan, where everyone had known everyone else since the day they were born, and it was worse for him than it was for most people, because of his father being public property. Our doctor, people called him, and having his office at home. Ian had noticed that they didn't call his mother our nurse, though. They called her Mrs. Christofferson, and left it at that. People were a little bit afraid of her, he knew that. She could be sharp. She could say, "The doctor is a busy man, Mrs. Schultz. Use your common sense." But they seemed to claim Ian's father as their own, and his home, too. And maybe, in the past year or so he had started to feel this, even Ian himself. Virtually everyone in Struan had sat in his father's waiting room at one time or another, waiting to have their sore throats looked at or bits of their fingers sewn back on, and while they sat, they had watched Ian grow up. Many of the older ones must have watched his father grow up as well. They would have seen him crawling around on the same wooden floorboards that Ian crawled around on, getting bigger by the day and gradually turning into their doctor. Ian was starting to suspect that they thought of him in the same way. Increasingly, he got the feeling that people looked at him and automatically thought, "Here comes another one, the next Dr. Christofferson." In fact, the previous week, old Mr. Johnson, who'd had his toes shot off 40 years ago at the Somme, and shuffled along with the help of two sticks, had stopped him in the street and asked if he could have more of them pills. Ian had said, "I think you should talk to my dad, Mr. Johnson," and the old man looked bewildered. He stood in the middle of the road, blinking up at Ian, his mouth hanging open with the effort of trying to make sense of what he was saying. Ian thought, "Oh, come on, I'm only 15. But everyone said he looked just like his father. The same big-boned, loose-knit Scandinavian frame, the same pale hair. Maybe if your eyesight was poor, it was hard to tell the difference. In the end, he took pity on the old man and guided him back onto the sidewalk before he got flattened by a logging truck, and said he'd have a word with his father about the pills. But the incident irritated him. In Mr. Johnson's case, it might have been just a matter of confusion and poor eyesight, but it brought home to him the assumption, unspoken but suddenly clear, that he would follow in his father's and grandfather's footsteps, as if he had no say in the matter, no ideas of his own. He imagined living in Toronto or Vancouver or New York. Think of the freedom. You could be whoever you wanted to be. No one expecting anything of you, no one knowing who your parents were, no one caring if you were a brain surgeon or a bum. Only, wherever he ended up, there would need to be a lake, or at least a river nearby. He couldn't live far from the water.
He cycled down Main Street to the outskirts of Struan, which took all of 3 minutes, and then out along the road to the Ojibwe Reserve, which took a further 5. The reserve was spread along the shore of a bay, with a point of land jutting out into the lake between it and Struan, a symbolic barrier, as well as a geographic one. The road ran out of pavement 1/2 mile before it reached the reserve, and the land itself was so low it would grow nothing but bulrushes and bugs, black flies by the million in early summer, then mosquitoes, big enough to pick you up and carry you away. The reserve store, though, where Pete Corbière lived, was situated right down by the lake, which meant it got the benefit of the wind and was less buggy than the rest. Pete's grandfather was sitting on the steps when Ian arrived, smoking and staring off into the woods. He had scars on his fingers from letting cigarettes burn down too far. "Hi," Ian said, leaning his bike against a tree. Mr. Corbière nodded in greeting. "You look busy," Ian said. He liked the old man, but was never sure how to approach him, and several years ago had settled on an uneasy jocularity that he now wasn't happy with, but couldn't seem to stop. Mr. Corbière nodded again.
"Working my butt off," he agreed. "Your rod's inside. Put it there to be safe. Kids were playing with it."
"Oh," Ian said. "Thanks."
"How's your dad?"
"He's fine, thanks, Mr. Corbière." He looked around for some sign of Pete. "Is Pete out already?" The old man jerked his head towards the lake. "Thanks," Ian said again. "Where's the rod?"
"Pete's room."
Ian stepped delicately around Mr. Corbière's broad rump and went up the steps into the store. It was dark and smelled of mold. A gigantic chest freezer hummed to itself against one wall. At certain times of year, the freezer was full of game. Rabbits, sometimes still unskinned, hunks of venison, ducks, geese, once a whole beaver, its tail stretched out flat. Beside the huge freezer was a smaller one, full of fish, and beside that, a smaller one still, given over to ice cream and popsicles. Along the back wall, there were a few shelves with tins on them, Heinz beans, tinned peaches, Irish stew. On the bottom shelf were 3 loaves of packaged sliced bread. At the other end of the room were hardware items, matches, fish hooks, batteries, snare wire, fly swatters, axes, woolen socks. No beaded moccasins. Beaded moccasins were sold by the roadside at rustic wooden trading posts, along with quill boxes and miniature birch bark canoes and totem poles 6 inches high. The trading posts themselves were advertised by large billboards portraying stern-looking Indian chiefs in war paint and full headdress. The Ojibwe had never gone in for headdresses, and the totem poles belonged 3,000 miles away on the west coast of Canada, but the tourists liked them, so the band went along with it.
"Wouldn't want to disappoint anybody," as the old man said.
Ian pushed aside a row of plastic strips hanging in a doorway and went into the back of the store. Pete and his grandfather lived here. The store was owned by a Scotsman. According to Ian's father, every reserve in the country had a store owned by a Scotsman who let Pete and his grandfather live there in return for minding the store. There were 2 bedrooms, a bathroom and a kitchen that consisted of a sink and a stove at one end of the hallway. Pete's room was small and square and stupendously untidy. Clothes and gum wrappers and schoolbooks and snowshoes not put away since March, and girly magazines left lying open as if the old man wouldn't mind, which he probably didn't. Ian's fishing rod was standing in a corner, looking new and shiny and very out of place. He retrieved it and went back outside. Mr. Corbière had started on another cigarette. Ian stepped past him.
"Thanks, Mr. Corbière."
"Catch a big one."
Ian grinned.
"I'll try."
Once he got down to the shore, it took him only a few seconds to spot the Queen Mary. She was across the bay by the sandbar at the entrance to the river, a good spot for pike, especially in the spring. By some trick of the light, the old rowboat seemed to be hovering just above the surface of the water, as if it were a ghost ship or something out of a dream. He watched it for a moment, and Pete's motionless shape within it. The evening was very still, and the water gleamed a dull silver. He cupped his hands to his mouth and yelled. The sound flew out across the water, and the figure in the boat moved and lifted a hand in acknowledgement. Then there was a distant putt-putt-putt from the little outboard, and the boat turned toward him. Ian walked out to the end of the dock.
"How's it going?" he said when Pete was close enough. The smell of gasoline and fish rose up from the boat, luring him in.
"So-so," Pete said.
The boat sidled up alongside the dock, and Ian jumped in, avoiding half a dozen glistening trout in the bottom. Pete pushed off and headed back across the bay. When he reached the sandbar, he cut the engine. The smooth swells of their wake caught up with them, rocked the boat gently, and moved on. "I can't stay long," Ian said, absently, picking through the tackle box for a suitable lure. "I should study. We got that biology test tomorrow." Pete stuck a mayfly on his hook and dropped it over the side of the boat. He said,
"You got your priorities wrong, man."
"I know, I know."
The tackle box was in a similar state to Pete's bedroom, lures and weights and hooks and bits of fur and feathers all over the place, with the odd dead bug tossed in for good measure.
"It could be 100 years, Pete said, giving his line a sharp jerk and hauling in a perch. "Maybe 200 before you get another night as perfect as this for fishing. But there will always, always be another test."
"Too damn true," Ian said.
He was still going to have to go back in time to have a look at the textbook, though. He and Pete shared the same policy, developed and fine-tuned over the years, of working just hard enough to keep out of trouble. But in Ian's case, being the doctor's son, the teacher's expectations of him were irritatingly high. They fished. Pete used a jigger, a stick with fishing line attached and minnows or bugs for bait, or sometimes just a weighted hook with a bit of deer fur on it. Ian used his fishing rod, which was a good one, a birthday present from his parents. If tonight was like other nights, and it would be, he would catch one fish to every 4 or 5 caught by Pete. If they swapped equipment, Pete would continue to pull them in, and Ian would continue to get next to nothing. It was a fact of life, and he had accepted it long ago. They had met through fishing. Ian wasn't sure if he actually remembered it, or if his father had told him the story at some later date. It was before they'd started school, so they would have been about 4 or 5. Ian's father had been teaching him how to fish, and had taken him around to Slow River Bay, and over by the sandbar at the mouth of the river they'd seen another boat which had turned out to contain Pete and his grandfather, also in the middle of a fishing lesson. Ian's father knew Pete's grandfather the same way he knew everybody within a radius of 100 miles, and he drifted over to say hi, and the two men started talking. Pete and Ian had eyed each other up and down, their fishing lines hanging in the water, and while they were busy doing that, both lines were grabbed. There had been a few minutes of chaos, Ian did remember that, spray flying, boats rocking wildly, both men trying to help without looking as if they were helping, and when the fish were finally landed and held up to be admired, Pete's was a 14-inch pike, and Ian's was a 4-inch sunfish. Neither boy had been able to figure out why the two men laughed so hard. Pete's grandfather had tears running down his cheeks. But the boys held up their catches triumphantly, grinning at each other across the gunwales of the boats, two skinny kids with their bellies sticking out, fishermen for life. The fact that from then on Pete had continued to pull in the big ones, and Ian had continued not to, was just one of those things. Ian reeled in his line, checked the lure, and stood up to cast again.
He whipped the rod back and forth, listening to the hiss of the reel as the line played out, and let it fly. The lure sailed out over the water, and then dropped down light as a raindrop. Not a bad cast. He began slowly reeling it in, the line drawing a delicate V-shape across the surface of the water.
"Got a job today," he said, after a while.
"Yeah?" Pete said.
"Yeah, my dad said I should work this summer. Saturdays, too."
"You still have time to fish?"
"Oh, sure. I'm working 8 till 6.
I'll still have evenings free." Pete nodded. He looked after the store in the summer while his grandfather acted as a guide for tourists who fancied themselves woodsmen and loved the idea of a real, live Indian guide. "Found this old engine up in the woods in northern Ontario," they'd say to their friends back in the manicured suburbs of Toronto or Chicago or New York, nodding casually at a bear's head nailed to the rec room wall. "Knows the country like the back of his hand."
"I'm working on Arthur Dunn's farm," Ian said offhandedly. He reeled in his line, checked the lure, and cast again. He was aware of Pete looking at him curiously.
"I thought it would beat being cooped up in town. There's a job going at the drugstore, but I didn't fancy standing behind the counter all summer long, listening to people complain about their headaches."
Silence from Pete.
"Or listening to women complain about women's stuff," Ian went on, and then paused, suddenly wondering if that could be his mother's problem. The menopause. He'd read about it when looking through his father's books in search of something, anything at all to do with sex. The whole business had sounded gross, but his mother was too young for that sort of problem. She was 19 years younger than his father, and had produced Ian when she was only 20. "Or old guys complaining about their ingrown toenails. I get enough medical crap at home."
More silence.
The problem with deceiving Pete was that they had known each other too long. A friend who has known you since you were 4 years old really knows you, whereas your parents only think they do. They fished. Across the bay, they heard the drone of an outboard, the sound gradually dying as it rounded a point of land. Silence settled again. Then two loons started calling to each other, laughing at some melancholy joke of their own, their cries shimmering back and forth across the water. The color was ebbing out of the trees, lining the shore, turning them from somber green to black. Pete said, as if 10 minutes hadn't elapsed, "Standing behind a counter is just standing, man. Working on a farm is work." He twitched the jig, paused a second or two, and then jerked the line sharply. A trout broke the surface 10 feet away. He hauled it in and dropped it in the bottom of the boat.
"You could have got a job at the sawmill," he said, rebaiting his hook and dropping it over the side again. "You'd get a job there easy as nothing. Every guy there's had bits of himself stuck back on by your dad some time or other. They'd make you foreman in 3 days flat. You'd be running the place in 2 weeks. Good money, too. More'n Arthur Dunn can afford."
"Yeah," Ian said. "But who wants to spend the summer working for Fitzpatrick? I'll take Arthur Dunn any day." Pete hauled in a 4-inch perch, too small to keep. He unhooked it and tossed it back into the water.
"You could have got a job waiting on tables in Harper's. Put a cup of coffee down here, pick a cup of coffee up there. Good money, easy work. Or the library, or the gas station."
There was another tug on his line. It was the tiny perch again, the hole in its mouth from last time clearly visible. Pete raised it to eye level and said, "Where's your brains, man?" The fish gaped in astonishment. Pete tossed it back over the side.
"Or the hardware store. Woolworths, the post office. Any of them would be better than a farm.
Especially Arthur Dunn's farm."
"The farm's okay," Ian said mildly. "The horses are kind of fun."
"The horses?"
Pete looked at him slitty-eyed. Then suddenly he grinned.
What? Ian asked defensively. Nothing, Pete said. Nothing at all.
They fished for another hour or so, but the pike weren't interested, and when Pete caught the little perch for the third time, they gave up and went home. His parents were both in the living room when Ian got back. His mother was sitting in front of the television, though for once she wasn't watching it, and his father was standing in the doorway. When he came in, they both looked around. There was a moment's pause, and then his father said,
"You're home early. Fish not biting?"
"Nothing worth hauling out of the water," Ian said. His mother was looking vaguely down at her lap. There must have been a crumb or a bit of fluff on her skirt. She picked it off carefully, studied it for a moment, and then dropped it on the floor.
Chapter 2. Toronto Board of Trade, visiting Northern Ontario. Cattle run amok. Men chased to lumber piles. Rifles used. Temiskaming Speaker. March, 1925. Arthur's earliest memory was of standing in the doorway of his parents' room, looking at his mother as she lay in bed. It was the middle of the day, but nonetheless, she was in bed, and Arthur didn't know what to make of it. The bed was very large and high, and Arthur could only just see her. She had her face turned toward the window. Then Arthur's father called from the bottom of the stairs that the doctor was coming, and she turned her head, and Arthur saw that she was crying. Then old Dr. Christofferson came, and with him Mrs. Luntz, Carl's mother from the next farm. Mrs. Luntz patted Arthur on the head and told him to go downstairs, and she and the doctor went into his mother's room and shut the door. Later cries came from the room. During all of this, Arthur's father sat in the armchair in the kitchen with his large, lumpy hands spread flat on his knees. His hands looked very strange lying still like that. Normally, if he was sitting down, they were busy mending something. In his memory, Arthur had only one picture of this scene, but from piecing things together later, he knew that it must have happened more than once, three times at least. Then there was a long spell when his mother was in bed, though she didn't look sick, during which time his father got the supper after coming in from the fields in the evening. Most days, Mrs. Luntz and other ladies from neighboring farms dropped by with food in big covered dishes, so all he had to do was heat things up. This wasn't a bad time, as far as Arthur could recall. He remembered his father giving him a dish towel and passing plates down for him to dry, and telling him he was doing a good job. He remembered carrying his mother's supper very carefully up the stairs and taking it in to her, and her smiling at him and thanking him. He couldn't remember what he did during the day while his mother lay in bed and his father was out in the fields. He was too young for school, so he must have played by himself. But he clearly remembered the day he heard his mother calling him from her room. He would have been just 5 at the time. He remembered hearing the panic in her voice, and the feeling in his stomach, a cold tightness like the grip of a hand as he ran up the stairs. His mother had her knees drawn up under the blankets. She looked afraid. Arthur had never seen fear on an adult's face before, but he had no difficulty recognizing it for what it was. "Go get your father," she had said. "Tell him it's coming. Run." Here there was a picture as well as a memory. A picture of himself flying along the edge of the fields, his feet stumbling on the clods of heavy, rain-soaked earth. "Dad! Dad!" Terror in his voice. What was coming? Something terrible, terrifying, and his mother all alone in the house, with no one to protect her. And then, some hours later, when it was dark, and the doctor had come along with Mrs. Luntz again, and they were with his mother, it became apparent from the screams that echoed down the stairs that they couldn't protect her any more than he or his father could. Arthur wanted to go to his father and climb onto his lap, but he was afraid of the look on his father's face and of the appalled silence between the screams. He wanted to go to his room and get into bed and cower there, but to do that he would have to go up the stairs and past the door with the dreadful sounds behind it, so instead he curled into a tight ball in the other armchair and stayed there until many hours later the screaming finally stopped. And then there was another sound, a bawling, like a cross between a crow and a sheep, and he knew that whatever it was had come at last and had triumphed, and his mother was dead. Except that in the morning there she was, not dead at all, but sitting up in bed, smiling, holding a bundle, and saying to him, "Come and see, Arthur. You have a brother. This is your brother. His name is Jacob. Isn't he lovely? You can call him Jake." Was that where it all started, then? Before Jake was even born, with the loss of those other babies? So that when Jake finally arrived, the outcome of all that pain and fear and grief, he would be so precious to his mother that she could hardly bear it? She carried him around with her all day, holding him tightly, fending off death with the crook of her arm. She loved the new baby. Oh, Arthur knew that. But her love seemed to consist mainly of an agonized anxiety. Arthur would see her looking at Jake with an expression almost of despair, as if she expected him to vanish at any moment, torn from her arms by some dark force. It didn't help that Jake was a sickly child, prone to colds and high temperatures. Or maybe he wasn't really sickly. Maybe it was her fear. One cough from the baby, and she sent Arthur's father to fetch the doctor, and the doctor's old car would come lurching its way down their driveway, windshield wipers battling against the snow. "Babies are tougher than they look." That was what Dr. Christofferson said. He said it many times, patiently, attempting to reassure her. But she was not to be reassured. Each new phase of Jake's development brought a whole new host of dangers, so many of them that Arthur wondered how he himself had ever survived. Once Jake started crawling, life became more perilous still. "Did I fall down those stairs ever?" Arthur asked his mother, after she had scooped Jake up from the top of the stairs. He had been some yards away, but from his mother's face, Arthur could see that it had been a near thing. But she had her face buried in Jake's neck and didn't hear the question. But he, Arthur, had probably been a big, tough baby. If he had fallen downstairs, he'd probably have bounced, whereas Jake would certainly be killed. The day Jake took his first step, Arthur was formally recruited to the battle against the forces of fate. From now on, and Arthur knew this was a long-term assignment, his first and foremost job in life was to protect his little brother. In fact, he didn't need recruiting. He already knew that his mother's happiness depended on Jake's well-being. Adoring her and needing her as Arthur did, what choice did he have? Here was another picture. Himself and Jake, aged about 9 and 4, playing in the farmyard. Beside the barn there is a pile of empty boxes, lightweight slatted crates that their father uses for carrying lettuces and tomatoes and other row crops to the market in Struan. Arthur is building himself a castle of crates, an impressive, many-storied structure. Jake has dragged one crate away for his own purposes. Something, a sense of unease, causes Arthur to look up toward the house. He can see the kitchen window from where he is, and he sees that his mother is standing at it, staring out at something. On her face is an expression of horror. Arthur's heart leaps in panic. He looks in the direction of her gaze and sees that Jake has pulled the crate over to the water trough and has climbed up on it in order to see what is inside. Arthur scrambles out of his castle and flies, shouting as he goes, "Get down, Jake, get down!" Still feet away, he launches himself at his brother, knocking him off the box and sending him sprawling and howling in the dust. The water in the trough was no more than 9 inches deep. A mouse might have drowned in it. In fact, from time to time, one did. But surely not a child. That was what Arthur's father said. Or maybe didn't quite say, maybe just looked a little puzzled at the fuss when he heard about the incident that evening. To Arthur, still glowing in the warmth of his mother's gratitude, it was an academic question, since he had acted not to save Jake's life, but to rescue his mother from her fear. But in any case, it turned out that his father was wrong to doubt the seriousness of the incident. A child could drown in an inch of water. Arthur's mother had read it in a magazine. An inch of water. It had happened. His father didn't argue, though Arthur could see that he had some difficulty visualizing it. He frowned to himself and narrowed his eyes. An inch of water? He studied his boots, but he didn't argue. He bowed to his wife's superior knowledge. Fatal accidents to children fell within her area of expertise. Even Arthur knew that. There were subjects his father knew about, such as the farm, and subjects his mother knew about, such as everything else. He knew that his father admired his mother for her intelligence. She read the Temiskaming Speaker from cover to cover every week, and on the rare occasions when the Toronto Daily Star made it all the way up to Struan, she bought that too. She was the one who wrote letters if they needed writing and paid all the bills. Arthur's father could read things, provided they weren't too complicated, and he could add up all right, but when it came to writing, his fingers were clumsy, and the letters and figures didn't come out as they were supposed to. Arthur's mother was better at dealing with people, too. The previous spring, when a late frost killed off half the crops and Arthur's father had to go and see the bank manager, she went with him to do the talking. Arthur's father knew what was needed to put things right, how much money he wanted to borrow, and how long it would take him to repay it, but he was afraid that in the enclosed space of the bank